everybody out there in Gearshift land. This is Robert Pandya firing up the microphone here and having industry conversations. In our world of pandemic shutdown these days, it's been really hard to kind of see motorcycling world and kind of understand, you know, what might happen. So I thought there's an opportunity to talk to a few different people. And one of the guys who I really, really look up, I look up to him now, but early in my career, I was a sport bike nut. I was a snob. I was a sport bike snob. Anything that didn't, you know, have clip-ons was kind of pointless to me. And, I didn't understand Harleys. I didn't get the vintage thing. You know, I thought old cafe racers were just old sport bikes that didn't cut it anymore, just stuff like that. So the magazine that I read all the time, whenever it came out, and, where some of the my heroes were written about and written by, the editor of that longstanding magazine, Sport Rider magazine, is Kent Kunitsugu. Kent is on the line with me. How you doing, buddy?
Good, thanks. How are you, Robert?
I'm great. Thank you. So I do want to go jump into the Wayback Machine a little bit with you, Kento. So, coming from a photography background myself, the first thing I did when I got Sport Rider is I would look at all the photographs. I wouldn't read one word except for photo credits, right? Mm-hmm. And I'd see the Jeff Allens, and I'd see, Brian J. Nelson, and I'd see, endless, you know, contributors, Golden Goose and stuff like that. Right. And I was just blown away by the quality of the photography, right? And then you go back and you say, like, well, I've looked at the photographs 20 times. I might as well start reading this stuff. So, you know, I go in and start reading and the editorials and, you know, how you would write about stuff and what you guys would get access to and the way you and, Andrew Trevitt worked together and different contributors would come into that magazine and everything. I just got to say that and this is not just blowing smoke up your leathers here, but Sport Rider magazine was really a backbone of my, you know, relatively early, you know, motorcycle world. And certainly was a key part in formulating, you know, what was cool about motorcycling to me, and has lived on with my friendships and appreciation for, you know, people in MotoGP and stuff like that. Can you maybe give us, a little bit of a background on Sport Rider, which is unfortunately is folded, but, man, you were at the clip-ons for some epic, epic stories and epic times in motorcycling, sport bikes.
I actually got my start at Motorcyclist magazine, ironically, because when Sport Rider started up, one of the editors at Motorcyclist, Jason Black, was hired over at Sport Rider, and so that created an opening at Motorcyclist. And I'd done some stuff with them before, and I actually kind of started because Nick Einach, who is the original editor of Sport Rider, he and I were kind of friendly racing rivals, I guess you'd say. One year, I mean, every 600 race that we went together in, we basically were tooth and nail the whole time. And so we kind of became friends over it, and then he just casually asked me if I was interested in helping him do some photography, and I said, sure. Get some stuff for there, and then it progressed to, hey, have you ever written anything? And I said, well, yeah, back in high school. He said, well, you know, here, take these set of gloves, you know, wear them for a week, and then write what you think of them. And so I did that. I mean, they liked what I did, and then it progressed to, well, here, take this jacket, wear it for a week, and let us know what you think of it. Did that, and then it was, okay, here, why don't you borrow this motorcycle for a while and for a week, and then let us know what you think of it. And, you know, naturally for me, I was, you know, wow, this is fantastic, sure. And then it just kind of, when the opening at Motorcyclist came up, they just they prodded me to apply for the position. But because I had not gone to school for journalism, I was thinking, well, there's got to be 1,000 other guys more qualified than I am. But I applied anyways, and I got the job at Motorcyclist, and I was road test editor there for 2 years. And then there is a shakeup at the publishing company, and then the basically they offered me the editor position at Sportwriter, and I kind of couldn't turn that down for sure. And so, you know, I basically took that opportunity and was at the helm of Sportwriter for 20 years.
Yeah, that's a lot of leathers, man.
Yeah, I mean, it was great too, because like you were saying, I mean, I kind of came in right during the 90s and early 2000s heyday of sport bikes. I mean, they were just, that market was growing so quickly that it was growing in double digits. I remember from when I first came into Sportwriter, it was growing in double digits when the actual cruiser market was starting to kind of level off. And so it was really I would kind of call it a kind of golden age for sport bikes, really, because they were progressing so quickly that the manufacturers were basically updating their models like every 2 years. Otherwise, they ran the risk of, you know, being left in the background because of the other manufacturers progressing so quickly.
Yeah, and I mean, to that point, I thought one of the stories I remember, I'm pretty sure you guys wrote this, was it a GSXR 750 and run it as possibly stock as you could, like to the point of pushing it through tech with the turn signals and the tool bag and the tail section. Was that you guys? Do I remember that right?
I don't remember a story like that.
Maybe that was Motorcyclist. Maybe Mitch did that.
Yeah, it might have been Motorcyclist.
Yeah. But I mean, the things that came up in the pages of Sportwriter were you getting invited to ride the number one plated AMA superbike or a world superbike racer or we're going to do some tire, you know, we're going to join Team Ducati for some tire testing it's the last race of the season and we've got the top four MotoGP bikes and we're going to ride them. And I'm like, holy shit, how do you get to do that? That is insane.
Yeah, those were some really great times. I mean, it was, you know, because the sport bike market was so, you know, it was growing so quickly, the manufacturers looked at it as extremely important. And part of that promotional part was MotoGP. So they, I think starting in 2007, 2006, maybe, they basically invited, you know, at the end of the season Valencia race, the day after on Monday, they would let, you know, they'd invite a select group of journalists and they let them ride, you know, MotoGP bike. Actually, not every day. I mean, let us go out on, you know, 6 laps or 4 laps. But I mean, you know, any lap on a MotoGP bike is, can't pass that up, even if you're not even close to really finding out what it's like. Although I did get the chance in 2005, when a friend that was working at US Suzuki, I basically told him, well, it should be great to get a chance to ride the Suzuki MotoGP bike because we'll see what I can do. And then he basically called me up one day and he goes, hey, so, are you available in November to go ride Suzuki? Actually, it wasn't even November, it was September, you know, to ride the Suzuki MotoGP bike. And I said, yeah, sure. And he goes, okay, you're going to be with the test. So it's not during a race. You're not going to be with the actual MotoGP team. And I don't care. And, it was basically just me and Alan Cathcart at Valencia. We basically spent 2 days there. I had complete access to the team, not the riders, the factory riders, but the test team. They actually let me see parts of the bike that I could photograph or talk about. It was really a fantastic experience. I mean, it just, there was so much there that I couldn't photograph or talk about that I was really, disappointed that I couldn't do it, but it was still great. I was still able to, you know, put together a great story because it was just spending so much time with the bike and the team and seeing how it worked. And I actually got 17 laps on the bike, which normally would never happen. I mean,
wow.
The teams would just be like, no, the run, running the risk of a journalist, you know, wadding up their million-dollar development machine. It was like, absolutely not. But it was, I mean, actually, it's kind of a funny story how I got those 17 maps. That can be for another time.
Yeah. Well, I definitely want to have more conversation about that and Sportrider and the people involved. So, you know, maybe we can do a part two on that. But, you know, we're living through, which has become the most stereotypical thing heard on the news, you know, exceptional times, that sort of thing. And, but even prior to all the stuff that we're dealing with now, and, you know, the crystal ball is murky as shit for everything right now. So, I mean, not even looking at that, but if we can go back to just a couple of years back, is when I decided to do the Give a Shift, roundtable thing. And I honestly can't, I thought it was going to, you know, I was going to lob it out on Facebook. I thought it was going to be like, you know, a handful of people, a couple of six packs and like a 2-page white sheet. I seriously thought that's what would be the output. And, huge, like 40 people put their hands up to apply, and they were not just like, you know, everyday, there was plenty of, you know, just like folks I'd never heard of before or whatever that wanted to participate. But I was just blown away, when you were on that list, you know, it's like, holy smoke, because that was soon after, Sportrider shut down, I believe. Is that right?
Yeah, it was. Yeah.
And so, we had a handful of editors, who were there, Kevin Duke and some others. And I didn't want the panel to be too editorial heavy, but I really wanted you there because sport bikes have gone through a significant, downturn, you know, and, you know, the end of Sportrider magazine was certainly part of that, but, sport bikes in terms of their interest and the, you know, the technology and the, and what the average human being can handle, now it's gotten to such a weapon out there. What's your opinion of like where sport bikes are versus where like the riders are, you know, again, looking back a couple of years to that period, did sport bikes out tech themselves, or did the motorcycle market under educate the rider base?
Basically, you had, you know, all these 20 somethings who, I mean, there's a lot of armed services personnel coming back from, you know, all the stuff that was going on in the Middle East. And so you had a bunch of these young people with a lot of money in their pockets, and they wanted, you know, something to keep their interest up, exciting or whatever, and sport bikes were, you know, a natural outlet. So, they were, you know, buying bikes like, you know, sport bikes like crazy on credit. But then once that whole implosion of the economic thing happened, it basically crunched everybody down. And so all these 20 somethings suddenly weren't able to, you know, there was no credit available, and or the insurance industry was rebelling against the amount of money they were spending versus the amount of income they were getting cash flow in for, you know, insuring the sport bikes. And that just kind of really killed off the market. I mean, I think, once you turn away a market, you know, with economic, you know, conditions, they turn their attention elsewhere. And so then there was also some upheaval going on with the road racing scene in the U.S. that maybe had a small contribution as well. And so there's just a whole bunch of outside influences that all kind of came together that were, I think, really out of the manufacturer's hands. So, I mean, I don't think that there was any, you know, over tech involved in it. I think it just, there was a lot of outside influences that all came together in a perfect storm and really just took the sport bike market, pulled the rug out from underneath it.
Do you think that there was always, the emphasis on, you know, even the power of a modern, 600 super sport, you know, when you compare that to a 10-year-old super bike is phenomenal, right?
Sure.
What strikes me, and I say this because I've been part of, you know, I used to run Buell's track day program, the Inside Pass, and certainly Aprilia's track day programs and stuff like that. But it seemed like, broadly speaking, the industry wasn't supporting sort of rider education and the ability to, pilot something like, and to fundamentally truly appreciate, you know, this bike that you have, you know? So it's pretty easy to say that somebody from, you know, an average rider can get on a 10 or 15 year old GSXR 750 and still scare the crap out of themselves, you know?
Yeah. I think that there's a definite lack of, the bikes were way beyond the vast majority of the market that was in there to buy them. But you could probably say that about a lot of either performance vehicles or, you know, sports or things that where it requires a high amount of skill to be able to really get the full potential out of that product.
Right.
But I agree though that there was a definite lack on the manufacturer's part of just creating the beginnings of the market that was going to purchase their products, i.e., you know, creating bikes that were, well, basically, for lack of a better term, beginner bikes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I remember constantly every couple of years bringing it up in my editorial in the magazine about, you know, we're not, you know, bringing up enough new riders into, or at least properly educating the new riders. And by that, I mean, you know, just beginner riding initiatives beyond the MSF course. And, you know, like you were doing with, the DTM thing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think that, you know, there was a distinct lack, you know, the manufacturers were way too concerned with, you know, and I think they kind of still are, you know, they're just concerned with selling the models, the money-making models that they had out there,
mm-hmm.
and not really concerning themselves with building up that younger base that's going to be purchasing their products.
Right.
I mean, back, you know, back during the heyday of the sport bike era, I mean, really the only beginner bikes you had were the 250, the Kawasaki 250 Ninja, and that was almost about it for a long time until Suzuki came out with the SV650, and even then, that really wasn't considered like a, you know, a beginner bike. I mean, you had Kawasaki's like their 500 twin, their EX500.
Mm-hmm.
That was slightly better, but not really. It was still,
It had the look, but it really didn't have the snort that, you know, that it
No.
Tried. Yeah. So.
Yeah. And I mean, the other thing too, though, is that there, I think the motorcycle community was still kind of, in sort of an elitist.
Yeah.
You know, mentality where it was, you know, it's understandable though. I mean, it's like, you know, you're proud of being part of a community that's different from everybody else, and it's a community that not too many people, at least in the U.S., wanted to get into because they considered it too dangerous or too rebellious or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and but I think that also contributed to the lack of, you know, newer riders being interested in motorcycling because they'd walk up to a group of bikes and they'd go, "Hey, nice bike," and you know, if they didn't know what they were talking about, you know, they'd get brushed off by a lot of guys because they weren't, you know, quote, a biker or, you know, a rider, unquote. And I see that attitude changing now, but I think it's, you know, I wouldn't say it's too late, but it's really late in the process.
Yeah, it is really late. And we got to work hard to play catch up. And I remember saying to somebody who's still in the industry, so I'm not going to use their name because I don't want to embarrass them, but it was somebody from one of the major Japanese brands. And, I was sort of taking Suzuki to task. This person wasn't with Suzuki, but I was using Suzuki as an example because in the Discover the Ride program at the motorcycle show, got into the conversation about what should be the hero of a particular lineup. And the thing about Suzuki is, like, to me, it clearly isn't the GSXR anymore. No. And the hero should be like the Van 200. And there should be a level, Suzuki has the opportunity to be the most fun motorcycle brand, major motorcycle brand on the market. They have a ton of models that are like under $5,000 of all different shapes, like a V-Strom 250 and the T250X and, you know, DRZ and, the Van. I love the Van because it's just so goofy, right? And the coolest thing would be to have like the Van a go-go on Pismo Beach and hand a bunch of these guys to, those bikes to custom guys to make, you know, American versions of Japanese brat bikes or, you know, make a surf bike. What does that look like? Or, you know, and just start really playing with that and make that end of our motorcycling spectrum so much fun that even the white beard, you know, crusty old, you know, I've been there and done that. I used to own a, you know, the GPZ 550 when it first came out and blah, blah, blah. That person would look at that scene and go, man, that looks like fun. I want to be around that and just bring the fun back into it. Because to me, motorcycling of all levels, and I'm, you know, I'll blame Indian at that level too, is it got to such a spec thing. That the fun part of it.
Yep. That's the word.
Really went away, you know, yep. And it's like that's the part that's missing.
Yep. That's the key term right there is fun. Yep. And that's where I agree where bikes, you know, like the Van and the Grom or whatever. I mean, you know, it's got to be about fun now because yes, for the longest time and I think, you know, sure. I think Sportrider contributed to it too. It's just, The motorcycle industry became ever more specialized as the years went on. And, you know, while you were able to, you know, find a motorcycle that was, you know, easier to be suited to your particular task, it also excluded a lot of other riders who didn't exactly want to do exactly that, whether it was a super sport bike or whether it was, you know, an enduro that, you know, a guy that wanted to go off-road a little bit, but still rode on the street mostly, you know, and I think that specialization also cut out a lot of potential motorcycle enthusiasts because, you know, they look at these bikes and they're thinking, well, you know, why do I need, you know, this, you know, why do I need a lap chart? Why do I need this thing for, you know, why do I need a 8-gallon tank? Why do I need, you know, this and this. I mean, they just want something that, you know, yeah, sure, they might be able to go off-road on it, but, you know, it's mostly going to be a commuter bike. And it's like, you know, you get all these ADV bikes that are becoming even more specialized now that they're, you know, they're basically, in fact, the manufacturers are now coming out with separate models that are either meant more for the pavement or meant more for off-road. Mm-hmm. You know, there's no do-it-all machine that how it used to be back in the 70s.
Well, I think as a culture, you know, we love seeing that specialized thing, you know. I mean, you can probably, you know, once the world reopens, you can go anywhere and see a conga line of, you know, Jeeps with tall tires and roof racks and stuff that are never going to get dirty, right? And so, I mean, everybody has an appreciation for that style. But the thing that I'm most disappointed in and the broader motorcycle manufacturer level and the national level concern, which is what we really wanted to address with the Give a Shift stuff, was the fact that we were all like sort of silos on the same farm, you know, and everyone's trying to accomplish the same goals because ultimately, you know, it's two wheels with a motor and then, you know, it's versions of that and it's always versions of, you know, freedom and control and there's only so many words, you know, and it's all the silhouette is, you know, when you look at the silhouette of any of the modern sport bikes, just pure silhouette, really hard to tell those things apart. They're starting, you know, I mean, they're really, and the same can be said for a cruiser. The same can be said for adventure bikes. The universal language that we all speak in these silos is this fun part and this approachability. And that stuff didn't get funded. Like, I don't know. Did you ever come out to Femmoto? Did you ever make it out to that? Or
I think I came out to one or two of them.
Yeah. And so there was a great example of something that Monty and Bonnie put together and I was able to be part of it was way early in the let's get, you know, women riding, you know, and so the lip service and the shrink it and pink it and some of the stuff that we talked about in the Give a Shift report. I mean, man, how long do we have to have that conversation? Right. And then all of a sudden, you know, MIC's got like they're puffed up about, you know, 20% female ridership or whatever. And I think one of the things, if I recall from the Give a Shift meeting that you really clicked with was the fact that, you know, if moms ride, the kids will ride.
Yeah.
And that was something that opens up our world, you know, completely.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, that is something where, you know, there's women they're undergoing a climate change where they're looking at themselves as being able to do a lot more things that were previously, you know, whatever thought as, you know,
like taboo, you know, almost. Right?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. I didn't want to use that word, but yeah, kind of, you know, I mean, it was frowned upon, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's like, you know, the sky's the limit. And therein lies the, you know, the possibility that there's an avenue there that needs to be explored. And I think, you know, the manufacturers are just, I don't know. I mean, I think a lot of it maybe goes back to because the Japanese manufacturers, you know, are based in Japan. And so the management there is still, I think a lot of them are way too traditional in their thinking.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't want to move beyond, you know, move beyond the traditional way of, you know, well, we market to these people and these people only. You know, I think that there's a lot of untapped markets that I think need to be looked at. And, you know, the fact that, you know, in the beginning in the 70s, you know, it wasn't just fun, but it was also the fact that it was a family-oriented mm-hmm. sport. I mean, you basically had people going out. You could back then, I mean, you could go drive an hour and you'd be out in the middle of the desert and you could just sit there and unpack your, you know, your RV and have a whole bunch of bikes and just, you know, make a big weekend out of it with the family. I mean, that's how so many people got their introduction to, you know, to motorcycling was, you know, going out with their dad and their family or something. And, you know, they were able to ride dirt bikes out in the desert. And, you know, that can't, it, or not can't, but it happens much, much less
mm-hmm.
because of various reasons. I mean, you know, the amount of space that you can ride now off road is shrinking rapidly. And
sure,
it's just, there's not enough, I don't know. There's just not enough people there getting the idea that this is something that can be, you know, a family outing that can be fun for everybody.
So that's, I mean, to be, you know, to put on some more rose colored, face shield, if you will, what's amazing to me is the electric revolution, you know, and if you extrapolate a brand like, Oset, for instance, right, they're making mm-hmm. kids electric trials bikes, right? Mm-hmm. And then they're starting to get up into nearly full adult size bikes that are strong enough for adults to ride on. But you've got this electric, trials bike thing that somebody can ride around in their own backyard and the HOA isn't even going to know about it. Mm-hmm. And, the fact that you can geofence a motorcycle, the fact that you can, that an adult would, in theory, be able to walk up to their kid's bike and go, well, you're doing really well. I'm going to allow you to go, you know, 14 miles an hour instead of capping you at 9, you know, just with a touch of a button.
Right.
that to me strikes as like one of the biggest opportunities coming up is by creating that access, you know, to that sort of thing. But to your earlier point, you kind of intoned that, you know, are we too late to this game?
Well, if the manufacturing, you know, I mean, not the manufacturers, but I mean, if the motorcycle industry, you know, as a whole doesn't start embracing, you know, all aspects of, you know, this new technology and, you know, electric bikes and everything, it is going to be too late because, you know, we're basically going to become irrelevant in the grand scheme of, you know, life's fun and memories.
Right.
You know, I think it saddens me to kind of see how slowly the, you know, the manufacturers, the MIC and the AMA are just, you know, they're reacting so late to everything that's going on. It's disheartening. You know, I mean, you would hope that some of these organizations would kind of be a lot less politically oriented and just be really concerned with the motorcycle industry as a whole, because that's, you know, that's where their revenue and their membership comes from. But I don't know. I mean, it's frustrating to see how slowly they're reacting to, you know, the market trends and what's going on. I mean, I think electric motorcycles, I think, have a ton of potential. I don't think that they were this silver bullet that a lot of people were making them out to be, mm-hmm. or, you know, maybe even not the silver bullet, but just saying that there's this, you know, that the electric motorcycle industry was going to take off. I mean, I think there's still some significant hurdles that, you know, the electric motorcycle industry still has to overcome. Number one being range, and then the accompanying weight issue. But, you know, and I think it's quite possible that, you know, those issues could be overcome, and then they would, as long as they price themselves in a way that makes them, you know, more accessible.
But they can be overcome if the emphasis, instead of being like, you know, speed and torque and acceleration and, you know, and range and stuff like that, if it's just the access to fun. I mean, that's, you know, that's there's been a faster revolution in design in motorcycling since I'd even say like 2 or 3 years of electric motorcycles. You know, talk about different silhouettes and different ways of interpreting two wheels and a motor to put together. The freedom and constraints that electric has is really pretty cool, because it's opened up, you know, there's a lot of engineers and designers who normally wouldn't pay attention to motorcycling are all of a sudden paying attention to electric two-wheelers, and that's bringing in a new perspective. But that's not happening from like the marketing and sort of the categorical promotion that,
yeah.
to your point, that the major manufacturers who are stuck in internal combustion land and trying to sell, you know, premium level bikes to a shrinking demographic, yeah. are kind of circling the drain, right?
Pretty much. I mean, it's, you know, it's they're trying to continually squeeze more blood out of that rock that's getting smaller and smaller, you know. And I know for a fact that one particular manufacturer is really, they're really in dire straits. Mm-hmm. And then another one's not doing so hot either. And I mean, it's, you know, there's significant problems that, you know, that they need to address, and they just need to make motorcycles more relevant. And I think that, you know, like back to what you were saying with the creativity that's coming forth now with, you know, a lot of bikes, and especially, you know, electric bikes, because they're different. It's, that's an opportunity to kind of get away from the traditional, again, you know, they had traditional, you know, advertising vein where they could promote something that's just different to get people's attention and then show them that, you know, this is fun. This is different. This is, you know, it's not about being a rebel, or it's not about being, you know, a racer. It's about just being fun and different.
The opportunity for the entire motorcycle industry to get behind a singular message. This is something I brought up in the, six months or so after we did the Give a Shift thing. We did a happy hour deal, at Lucky Wheels Garage. And, the thing that I wanted to bring up is that there's no categorical slogan for motorcycling. There's no just do it, or, you know, got mm-hmm. milk. Got right. milk is a better example, right? So, yeah. There's nothing like that Ducati would have a way to express it, and Harley would have a way to do it, and Revit, and, you know, Geico Motorcycle Insurance, you know, that the leadership from AMA and MIC and whoever else you want to name, FIM on a international level, to elevate interest in motorcycling by all of us singing at least from the same hymnal. At least getting behind the core message of, particularly coming out of a, you know, an international pandemic, that if you want to experience an analog joy again in your life and really feel outside and feel freedom, that for a significant percentage of the population, a small displacement or a easier to access electric motorcycle may be just the thing. And you don't need to worry about going 200 miles on a,
right.
on a battery. If it's just that, like that sort of, that experience that feel like getting on a swing set when you were a kid, it was just a rush. You didn't do it for hours and hours and hours. You were just, you know, you'd get that rush and then you'd go off and do the next thing. Right.
Sure. I mean, when I talk about I totally agree with all that you just said. When I'm talking about the range factor, I think that it's that area that I'm coming from is more related to, you know, we have to find a way. When I say making motorcycles relevant, you know, we have to figure out, well, not have to, but I mean, it's, I think it's important that we figure out a way, that the industry figures out a way to make motorcycles more relevant in daily life. Mm-hmm. And I think there's the opportunity with, you know, I think we're in the waning years of, you know, the internal combustion engine. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and I think that that's where, you know, the electric power industry is, you know, going, you know, has potential to make some major impact. But I think that in order to do that, they're going to need to have, because that's the reason that the, you know, the electric power industry has taken over the automobile industry, because right. they're able to have that. They're able to market the fact that you have this, the same range, or if not better than your internal combustion counterparts, and, you know, saving money at the same time. And I mean, it's, you know, that's the whole reason that at least where I live, you see so many, you know, electric vehicles on the road now, all electric vehicles on the road now, because mm-hmm. they're just, you know, they have the same capabilities as their internal combustion counterparts. And yeah, they're a little bit more expensive, but there's more people buying them, and you can't get around that. And it, you know, because it made them more relevant in daily life, they're, that whole market increase comes hand in hand with just making them more relevant.
Yeah. Yeah. I hear what you're saying. I hear what you're saying. I think, so, you know, part of the challenge is that, the approachability of motorcycle. So this is why we came up with Discover the Ride, is that, if my theory was, if you knew the basics of how to ride a bicycle, I could teach you the core stuff on how to ride a motorcycle in 10 minutes. And I literally, I had people from the Japanese, senior management from the Japanese bike industry, and KTM and a Harley was like sort of lingering on the edge, right? But at the Long Beach IMS show where we made this debut, it was kind of a soft rollout of Discover the Ride, because overarching sentiment was that all we were going to do is be stacking up bodies at the end of the straightaway. You know what I mean? This is just going to go straight and torpedo through the wall. And that's what we were going to do. And they didn't, it took a year, for me to get my first major, OEM representative to actually throw a leg over the bike and ride it and understand how approachable we had made the bike, but not by shrinking it down and turning it into like a Grom like cutie pie thing. I mean, the Zero, you've ridden, you know, Zero bikes, right? And they're pretty snappy. They're really quick and they'll high side you faster than anything else on the market probably. Right. Except the new, the new one's really good. But the, but the way we were able to dial it back made the bike incredibly approachable. So a ton of people who didn't think they could do this saw other people who didn't look like they could do it trying it and succeeding. And, you know, and then they were inspired. I saw, I mean, I could tell you stories of just dozens of women whose boyfriends or husbands were there like, oh no, you should blah, 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 getting poo-pooed by the old man. They'd get on the bike and they would have that experience. And I remember this one woman, I think it was at the Washington DC show. I saw her Saturday with her husband and he was like kind of trying to pull her away from the experience. And she said, no, I want to do this. So she stands in line and he's holding the purse, you know, and then, so she goes out and does the thing, is very successful. Listens to it, is great. And, you know, I congratulated her on getting it all done. And then Sunday rolls around and I look up and she's there by herself without the husband. And she's like, yeah, he wouldn't let me look at the bikes I wanted to look at. So I just had to come back and do this by myself. And I'm like, I think I may have contributed to the divorce rate in the local area, but however, but that sort of access, that's the kind of thing that I feel like we need to do, you know, to really step this up. So if I were to, you know, wave a magic wand and give you an opportunity to, you know, control a budget or a product line or a program, you know, for 5 years, what is it you would love to do in motorcycling? Knowing what we know now and how we have to get out of whatever quagmire we got, what's your opinion on what you would like to do ideally?
If I was at a manufacturer, you mean?
I don't know that it's a manufacturer thing. I wrote an article begging Keanu Reeves to buy the AMA so that we could have some celebrity to, you know, to like give us that spark of, you know, and if, God, if he did that, I'd go work for that organization in a freaking heartbeat. But the, in your mind, if you can invent something or if it's an OEM thing or if it's a, industry thing, is there something you've thought about that you're like, man, if we could just ... Or you would like to be a catalyst to create ... Have you thought about that?
I think that, it would be somewhat aligned to, you know, what you're doing with DTR. But at the same time too, I would not, you know, limit it. I would, you know, hopefully there would be the financial means. I would get it out there. In as many, you know, public gatherings and arenas, you know, hopefully when things, you know, with this whole coronavirus thing cool off, you know, as many public gatherings and sporting events as possible, because it's, you know, it's getting the message out there that is, you know, hugely important. And I think that, you know, again, I think the manufacturers just, you know, I mean, doing these things at the IMS shows is great and all, but it's gotta be way past that. You know, I mean, granted, you know, when you're at an IMS show, people know what they're coming there to see. Whereas if you do it at, say, you know, if you figure out a way to, you know, get it done at, you know, a major sporting event like, you know, football or baseball or soccer or whatever, mm-hmm. you know, just getting the product out there and in front of people so they can see it with that type of message, you know, being fun and accessible and, you know, not this, you know, racing or, you know, specialized thing. It's just fun. It's two wheels. You can ride around. You know, it's more fun than a bicycle, et cetera, that type of thing. Mm-hmm. You know, that's what I would want to do, is just be able to get your concept of, you know, discover the ride and just, you know, bring it farther out even more. Just like have, you know, all the smaller bikes available for the kids and just expanding everything to the point that it just becomes, you know, a sub event to itself. I mean, I think that there's getting the general public interest back in the fun of motorcycling, I think is what's lacking right now. And there's, you know, I understand that the motorcycle industry is really hampered right now financially. So they don't have the financial means to do it. But I mean, if I was looking at a crystal ball, I mean, there'd be great if there'd be some, you know, financial angel to come along to help just provide that spark that is going to be able to enable you or, you know, whoever with the right message to get out there in front of the general public and, you know, just promote motorcycling the way it was back in the '70s. Just fun.
Well, I tell you the thing, and thank you for the compliments in there. I think the thing that it's a phrase that I've said for years, and it really, you know, hit me when I was working with Victory Motorcycles. And that is that this motorcycle industry has the keys to cool. It is undeniably yes. cool for anybody, yep. whether it's a motor-maid grandma or a four-year-old kid. Mm-hmm. It's undeniably cool to control the wind by getting on a motorcycle, twisting that throttle, and feeling yourself propel through time and space. Mm-hmm. I would say one of the most unique, outside of like hang gliding or something, you know, one of the most unique, forms of transportation. But when you overlay unique to accessible, motorcycling is like straight, it's like right in the crosshairs, you know? Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so, you know, everyone who has a one car garage can still fit a motorcycle
yep.
in there with their car. Right.
Yep.
And so, the opportunity with us as an industry having the keys to cool is to turn around and partner with industries that aren't cool but have money, with industries that are bigger apparel brands that need to stretch out to their own audiences, that need to, you know, we did a partnership with Indian Motorcycle and Wrangler Jeans. Wrangler wanted to. They had a big advertising campaign. They were throwing up billboards around Sturgis. The people at Harley Davidson, there was something going on. I think they had a shitty meeting or a bad relationship. Harley had this attitude and sometimes still does. We're like, well, we don't need anybody's help. We got it figured out.
Yeah.
And that's been a challenge.
That elitist attitude yes. that I was
major problem that they're still trying to climb out of that hole. So, but I, you know, I loaned them some Indian motorcycles and they had billboards all over the place. And I remember upper management from Polaris comes rolling in to Sturgis and like every fourth billboard was a Wrangler jeans ad, but it might as well have been an Indian motorcycle correct. Ad
yeah.
because no one's looking at the guy's jeans. They're all checking out the motorcycle and yeah. every motorcycle in the ad was an Indian. Mm-hmm. And so they gave away like hundreds of thousands of pairs of jeans for free at Sturgis. You got this little coupon and you'd download it and you could get a free pair of jeans, right? Mm-hmm. To have that kind of money, to have that kind of access and brand recognition, for Wrangler Jeans not to partner up with a Discover Motorcycling initiative at the pro you know, like a pro rodeo series, a national pro rodeo series, or, you know, horse and RV shows. These are already people who are already outdoors, who are already accepting, you know, that you should spend money to access fun and that, you know, that, that it's worth that effort, right? Mm-hmm. That to me is like such a great, huge opportunity. And I just, you know, I'm frustrated. I don't want to end this on a frustrating note here, but no. I'm frustrated the fact that we haven't gotten there and that we can't seem to elevate this conversation, you know, in a way that's going to get more people. It's not that, you know, when you're racing, and you have a bad lap, if you focus in on that bad lap, or if you make a mistake in that one corner, and you keep dreading that one corner that's coming up that keeps screwing you up, it's going to ruin the entire rest of the race and rest of the lap, right? Yeah. So we can sit and browbeat over, you know, over products from the past or attitudes from the past or the fact that OEMs would only like sort of, do editorial assistance on big, fast superbikes and they didn't really want to do stories on, you know, on lightweight, fun, approachable bikes, right? They didn't want to spend the money to do that, right? So, we can go and lament all that stuff, but the fact is we got to get past the mistake we made in the last lap so that we can keep our head up looking around the apex for the next, for the next opportunity because we have so much of what this world is going to be looking for, particularly when we get out of this quagmire.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think that's, you know, that was one of the things that I wanted to touch on too, is the fact that it's, you know, I think people are going to want to be just, you know, getting out and just doing stuff. And I think that, you know, getting into the outdoors and just being active and doing something. And I think that, you know, it's a prime opportunity to get out there and show them that we're part of that whole, whatever you want to call it, that whole matrix of just getting out in the outdoors and being active and having fun and, you know, just having fun with, you know, a bunch of like-minded people.
Right.
I mean, it's not an easy, you know, there is no easy answer, obviously, but I think it's an opportunity that at least needs to be approached with some more enthusiasm by the industry. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, I think it is, the clock is kind of ticking on, you know, the motorcycle industry in general. I mean, I think that, you know, if it doesn't start doing something soon in some sort of unified manner, I really fear for the sport's health in general.
Yeah.
Again, yeah. I don't mean to end that on a dour note, but it's, you know, I think again, it's, you know, we're basically both, you know, preaching to the same choir. It's just there really does need to be some movement on the part of the industry as a whole. And, you know, I mean, there are some companies that are, you know, making their impact, but like you were talking about earlier, there's no unifying voice. Mm-hmm. And it needs to be more of a unified voice in order to make some sort of an impact. And yet, you know, I remember when you had the first GiveShift meeting, you know, there were people, I saw a lot of people poo-pooing it because they were saying, well, why are you guys just, you know, bitching about, you know, what's wrong with the motorcycle industry? You know, why do we need to, you know, if we start going to the, you know, general public and the general media and start saying motorcycling's in trouble, then we will be in trouble. Well, you know, if the patient is going on life support, you kind of want to know, let people know that patient is on life support so that hopefully somebody can, you know, come along that has an idea that will help them.
Right. Yeah. The industry's burying their head in their sand for many, many, many years now, you know, and I really, it's really opportunity. And I think when, you know, it's been a while. It's probably been a year since I've gone back and read that report. I probably just need to go back and read it again, but it was not a, you know, I've used this analogy before. When you're at a track day and a rider coach comes up to you and says, "Hey man, I was chasing you through these corners and, you know, you'd do a lot better if you just, you know, lifted your head and hang off a little bit more and turn a little bit later and blah, blah, blah." That as a student rider, or even an experienced rider, if somebody faster than you gives you a suggestion, you're like, "Oh, dude, thanks, man. That's, you know, I'll try mm-hmm. that," right?
Right.
As an industry, when we say, "Hey, man, you know, it'd be a lot better if we don't just shrink it and pink it, and if we actually, you know, support some initiatives with smaller motorcycles and stuff like that," that the industry doesn't want to hear it, or the OEM reps particularly, they don't want to hear it. They're like, "No, I got it. I don't need your help. We got it handled."
Right.
And I think that the core strength of this industry are the enthusiasts who are drawn to it. Mm-hmm. And I think maybe that's that positive message that's a good place to end with, is that I know that the empowerment that you get, the feeling you get when you first twist that throttle, is like that first snort of cocaine or whatever. Not that I've mm-hmm. ever done that, Kent. My mom listens yeah. to this podcast. Mom, I don't
right.
snort cocaine.
Right,
but
right.
the, but it's like that first rush. And it may not even be going that fast. My first time I had a rush, it was like riding this Cushman powered scooter thing through a bush into the side of a house. Right. And I was like, "Wow, right. that was amazing. I want to do that right. again." Right. And so, yeah. that opportunity for us who, as an industry, we have the keys to cool, to facilitate that on a wider level and to partner with brands that are going to be looking for positive outdoor messages
yep. Yep.
coming out of this mess. I don't care if it's you know, a hot sauce company, you know, there's so much, iconic cool factor to motorcycling that we can associate with as an industry, that's the great opportunity that's out there. And I feel like when we, you know, when we were talking about it, it was coming out of this spirit of a rider coach saying, "Well, here's your mistake, but here's how we can do better. I'm not going to focus in on the mistake. We're going to focus in on how we can do better mm-hmm. Together."
Yeah. I mean, I think that when you're talking about, you know, the, you know, whatever the manufacturer representative saying that, you know, "Hey, yeah, you know, thanks, but I got this." That's, you know, that's the thing that I really wish would change. You know, there needs to be some fresh thinking out there. I mean, I really wish that, you know, somebody from the manufacturer would be listening to this podcast and hearing what you're talking about and the ideas that you're bringing forth. I mean, the industry really does need this fresh overhaul of thinking, and not that I have anywhere close to those ideas or anything, but that's what it needs. Is it needs some fresh thinking, and the status quo is not going to come close to handling it now. There's just absolutely no way. There needs to be a climate change of ideas and thinking on the part of just the creative side on the industry as a whole.
Yeah, there's such a insanely great opportunity in front of us, and it's going to look different than what we thought, but that's the exciting part. It's gonna look different, because what we've looked at in the last 10 years ain't so great. So
yeah. I mean, it's, you know, when you're talking about the keys to cool, I was just thinking about the fact that when I, you know, went out for a ride yesterday, you know, a couple times during the ride, when I was coming back home, I was stopped at a stoplight, and you know, either a group of kids or family would be going by on the crosswalk on their bicycles or, you know, passing by. And the look of interest and awe in the kids when they were riding by, just staring at, you know, the motorcycle mm-hmm. or me or whatever, but the motorcyclist. You know, that's that seed of interest and passion that you know, needs to be applied. I mean, it's there. It's there for the taking. It's there for the creation.
Man, goosebumps. Exactly right. Every single motorcycle rider out there has had that moment where you're sitting on the bike and you catch the kid looking at you. Yep. And for just that fraction of a second, you see yourself or you see your own child in that kid. And yep. You're like, oh man, but, you know, I sparked something. And, yep. And you realize that you might be a little catalyst for a change. And I really think that, that's something that we can all do. And I really hope, that before it's going to be months before, you know, the word normal even starts to feel normal anymore. And, but that said, I hope for this entire industry that, these kinds of conversations can happen. And they can happen now in a forum where more people who are sitting idle or who are working on their own motorcycles in their shops, you know, or in their garage, that project bike they've been working on, you know, boy, talk about an opportunity to launch, you know, projectbike.com or whatever right now. It's, you mm-hmm. know, it's like, here's, you know, Revzilla and Cernix and some of these companies are actually doing gangbusters right now because people are buying stuff to work on, you know, motorcycles that are project bikes that they've been waiting to, you know, and that's one of the first things all of us want to do is to get back out and, you know, go ride and go sit at a coffee shop for a minute and bench race with some buddies and, you know, mm-hmm. get back to our version of normal. And I think that the wave of riders coming out there is going to speak to the enthusiasm that is the core of this industry. And if we can just start having these conversations earlier rather than, you know, being behind it again. I think that's really a key for us because, you know, we can shape our own destiny here.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you know, I wish the motorcycling media landscape hasn't changed so much because it, you know, that was a conduit to, you know, at least some of the manufacturers' ears. And, you know, I really hope the manufacturers, you know, the major manufacturers come around to realizing that, you know, there really is this untapped source of interest and promotion in the product that, you know, is there for the taking. I mean, it's there. It just needs to be grabbed with both hands.
Well, I tell you what, there's somebody out there has a contact for some marketing manager at Under Armour or Dasani Water or whatever. And they are going to be looking for that unique, inspiring message as we come out of this mess.
Yeah.
And I don't care which OEMs start to pay attention.
I don't either.
First. The fact is that, there can be initiatives out there that within a few months, OEMs will be begging to take part in because they will see that, this is already happening with or without them. And that is, you know, if any of our listeners out there, you know, have an opportunity and want to talk about these, or have a contact or, you know, any number of, companies, insurance companies and, you know, companies, everyone's going to be looking for a message to get out. And,
I mean, I think with LinkedIn now being so popular, I mean, I mm-hmm. think that that's an avenue that could be exploited. You know, I think that with
straight up.
Numerous connections out there, you know, I'm sure there's avenues that could be explored to get that message to somebody at, you know, whichever product like you were talking about that could, you know, partner with, you know, the motorcycle industry in some way, shape or form to, you know, help get the message out for both brands.
Yeah, man, that's it. That's going to be it. And then all of a sudden, you know, guys with, red shirts, the survivors who have red shirts, blue shirts, yellow shirts, green shirts, orange shirts, black shirts, all those guys are going to be going like, oh man, what are you guys doing over here?
Yeah.
We're just firing up the keys to cool. If you guys want to supply some stuff, great. Come on for the ride. I think we can do it.
Yeah.
Sounds like the cops are coming for you, buddy.
Yeah, I know. Yeah.
That's it. The MIC just called in a bomb threat to your house or something.
So. Yeah. They're gathering out front. Sorry.
Well, listen, Kento, I honestly appreciate, the time today. I know we all have time, but, right now, but it's special to talk to somebody that I have respect for, that I know you fought the good fight, and always put out a great, product and everything you did. And I've always I've had respect for your work and your perspective. And, it's truly an honor to hear your voice in this thing. I wish you and your family, all your extended friend network, the best. We've got some more tough times in front of us here, but this has been an inspiring talk to know that it's really on us to elevate the category. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Robert. Thanks for having me on the show. I mean, I appreciate all the, props on Sport Rider. I mean, that was my passion for 20 years. I put, everything in my heart and soul into that magazine because, for me, the sport and the readership were what was truly important. And, that's how I'm thinking now is, I really, want the sport to survive. I want to see it keep going. And that's the most important thing. So again, thanks for having me.
Yeah, man, you bet. I'm going to dig into some cardboard boxes and dig out some of my Sport Rider photo annuals. I got Brian Jay to sign one of them for me. So that was cool. I'm going to go back and look at some good times back there and know that there's more to come. So, thanks to all you, Give a Shift listeners out there. We appreciate it. And we are serious. If you've got, some contacts who think, or who want to hear how motorcycling can be that expression of freedom and fun at the end of a international pandemic, then I think, Kent and I, we got some time to get on a conference call, right?
Sounds good to me.
Excellent. All right, everybody, have a good time out there, and we will stay safe, and we'll see you out on the road someday at some point. Thanks, guys. Take care.